children who children of the divorced parent who dies with the month of
deliverance. I can speak for my own special case where I've had a fellow contract change. And since that way that he was off for 6 months, in 6 months, and he did get Social Security. And the family is now receiving after that way that he didn't get Social Security. He was a man about 48, 47, 48 years
old. And the age of them deserves it.
Is anything further? One of the suggestions took into consideration the possibility of Social Security benefit. And if those benefits are not payable, then our consent committee suggestion would have been for payments considerably higher than these. What we were aiming at is something which would be similar to a situation where if a man got divorced, he would have to make payments to his children, support parents, and we tried to use that as a kind of a guideline. The bill came in at $75 a month per child, only in one city category. So we have added the other categories, and because of the fact that we have broadened it to include all categories of children now, the original proposed compensation payments were made considerably less than the original proposal.
You've not brought in any way the scope of the people who are eligible.
No. No, we have no. It's just simply an increase in dollars to those people who are eligible.
Further discussion? All in favor of adoption of the proposed amendment dated April 22nd, 75 of 29, and in the call of the proposed amendment, in the first call of the roll.
Her name is A.B. Peterson.
Yeah.
It's all one name. Probably somewhere in the range of $25,000 to $75,000. $1,000 addition.
Addition to what you now have.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, the reason this bill is here has nothing to do with the money in it. Although I agree if we increase your power strength to come, we need to do more money on the waste management. The reason it's here is that it's definitely feeling among some in the legislature, the board and state labor management relations board, is that they have any power to offer what is offered at the national level.
Well, the board of following the election has no investigative or power or authority, whatever. We don't know what happened. But to my personal knowledge, there was one instance where the labor union won the election and the employers did not bargain. Understand under the terms of this present statute, if a labor union wins an election, there is no demand on the part of the law that the employer bargain. There is no protection for employees either with regard to keeping their jobs. If a small employer finds that there is union activity, he can fire everybody and hire people. And there is no such thing as an unfair labor practice at that level. Only when there is interference with an election. The only basis for any kind of unfair labor practice, unfair where there is interference with an election.
So on the case, as an example, I had another one on Butcher for a number of years and had one butcher. One butcher was non-union. He started to stay that way and he stayed there for 2.5 years and put out of business. You know, nobody would cross the picket line and delivery and carry it. Pick up people would cross the
picket line. What do I know about the case? Nothing at all, because no petition is in the file in my knowledge with our board. No petition for an election. Of course, there was only one employee. We could not hold a secret election because everybody knew how he voted. This is a policy.
Well, they know us. Take part. What is the recourse to an employer on a basis like that? The employee.
Under the existing law, I know of none, sir. We have one employee who will not get an election under either the state or the national relations.
Interesting to the state.
Take part.
Small interstate business.
Yeah. Mention was made that we do not have a piece of very much significance. And point out to you that this law applies to nonprofit organizations. We have held elections for employees of Reed College and the Library Association of Portland. The Library Association of Portland, I think, there's 226 people voted in that election. You could hardly say that it is not some significance. I believe that this law is, Mr. Rogers, as of significance in this, that it's very fact that it's there, that the employers and union members, the union employee representatives can ask for an election to determine whether or not the employees are going to be represented by a labor union and what union.
But the very fact that it doesn't have any significance that makes them not together, doesn't it? The very fact that there's no relation to the election and what actually transpires after makes them not together.
Well, I hear there was one instance where a union won the election and the employer refused to bargain. In all of the cases where there was an election, both parties abided by the result. We have no reports to contrary.
Well, now we have this market basket stores where an election was held and there was no union didn't, and yet they were put out of business because they...
Market basket stores?
Yes, here in Salem.
We have no jurisdiction where the volume of business, the retail business, is in excess of $500,000 a year.
This was in...
None of the... I don't recognize the name at all.
Who does have jurisdiction?
The National Labor Relations.
You mean? No.
At what level?
The global market?
Yeah. Well, if all of a sudden power comes up, there's so many holes in this statute. The only way to come up is to take a look at the statute. The only way to correct would be to raise it by one or two. See, now, what is Peter Smith? What is
prisoners having volume less than $1.5 million.
And asking for a certification election.
Is not, the jurisdiction is not accepted by the National Labor Relations.
But our
board can take jurisdiction.
Only if a certification election is declared, right?
If a petition is filed, then yes, that's
the
starting point.
But it has to be asked to request certification. In a situation where the employer does not wish to be certified, then we don't have a jurisdiction.
Well, if he wants to determine whether or not the employees want to be represented by a union, then the employer should file a petition with our board. That's extraordinary. How do we know that we have no authority to step into a situation on our own motion?
But where he doesn't want to be organized, and he's got a ticket out in front of his line, or out in front of his store, and he's not making a request to you because he doesn't want to have an option, then you have no jurisdiction.
We have no jurisdiction on our own motion under any circumstance. We cannot step into a picture and say, you must have an election at this place.
Well,
I didn't hear what they
said. No. This bill, there was a bill before the committee last time that brought up that Bill Wiley down in the voting spring. He brought in a bill because they couldn't get an election, because they couldn't get a jurisdiction. He brought in a bill for the amendment of existing.
Recognize the union. The fact that the picket is there, the union position, I believe, would be that this is informational picketing. That this store simply does not have a contract with the union.
Is anything wrong with informational picketing?
Pardon?
It's just that freedom.
Yeah. It's just that freedom of speech.
Well, let's assume that the owner thinks it's really good for public relations and publicity, and he enjoys being picketed because it increases his business. It's bad for the rest of the people in Oregon to have this sort of thing. It's just bad public relations, so we've got to change the law so you can do something about it and stop it. They have an election, and you hand down the decision of the election. It's the end of it. Then go pick some other place, maybe get the news.
Of course, our board does write the law.
That's what we're talking about here. It's a lousy law that makes you mute. Tied your hands at once, can't do anything, accomplish anything. And other members of your own committee agree that you can't do anything.
Other questions, Mr. Smith? No, thank you very much, Mr. Smith. Anyone else want to testify for this? I mean, in regards to this, to the board, to the bill,
did not have. Board, and I think with good reason. I'm sure that in the previous hearing you had all kinds of testimony as to the history of this thing. It was Senate Bill 207 of 1961, which was the result of a interim committee on labor management relations. There was a companion bill, Senate Bill 206, which did not pass, which would have done all the things that would have put it into conformity practically with the National Labor Relations Act. There is, in this session, I had a bill drafted and was in legislative council for some 3 months. This is a complex field, and I hope you all realize that. However, Senate Bill 527 was tabled last week by the Senate committee because it was introduced so late in the session, would have taken care of all these problems that have come up here. You recall 2 years ago, before this committee, no action was taken simply because the governor had indicated his wish to have a lay committee of people from labor and management come up with a recommendation for this session. Unfortunately, this was followed through by the governor's office, and I've kept them closely advised on the progress of the draft of Senate Bill 527. It's my hope that in this interim there will be an effort put forth by some agency of government to see that something like Senate Bill 527 is enacted. Now this, Mr. Peter Smith, and certainly I've known him for years, is sincere in his statements that the committee or the Labor Management Relations Committee has done the best they can, board, pardon me, not a committee, has done the best they can with the tools they have to work with. However, 42 of those petitions that were filed in 1968 for elections were done by a psychotic business agent in Eugene, who is no longer with us, fortunately, but he just arbitrarily asked for, filed these petitions for representation elections in 42 different restaurant operations in Wayne County. Why, I don't know. I asked him to withdraw them because it was ridiculous in the first place. However, those cases were never followed through after investigation was made. So I can see no reason for the continuation. I know it's an infinitesimal amount when you figure it against the entire general fund appropriation in the state of Oregon. But I hope that the committee members here would join with me in urging the governor's office to take action during the interim for the proper drafting of something so you haven't got one standard of procedures to follow before the National Labor Relations Board on interstate problems and one to follow in the state of Oregon on intrastate problems. Now, as far as the D&L drugstore situation on Denver Avenue and Lombard in the city of Portland, this thing was going along beautifully until former Representative Fred Meek stuck his nose into the area and guaranteed the proprietor of that place that the Portland Independent Drug Association would have all the financing they could possibly need to fight unionization. Threats were made by the employer on those employees, which was certainly in itself an unfair labor practice. And the election results indicate, I think it was a 5-0 vote or a 6-0 vote or a 5-1 vote or a 6-1 vote. It happened about 5 or 6 years ago, and I can't remember all the details. However, I can certainly sympathize with the problem confronting the committee in that something definitely has to be done. This appropriation is certainly not the vehicle. You've got to go into the entire concept of labor management relations in the United States. This includes unfair labor practices both against the union or representatives of the union and the employers or representatives of the employer. There's a question in that D&L drugstore, since they are a member of the Portland Independent Drug Association, whether they come under the jurisdiction even of the state board, because certainly the total volume of the association far exceeds $500,000 in total gross revenues in any one given year. I would urge that to bring this thing to a head, to force the issue in Oregon, that this appropriation measure be tabled. I think this, more than anything else, would bring it to a head and force labor management in this state, who deal constantly in the intrastate area, to come up with something that the next session of this legislature would have to act on.
Questions, Mr. Martin?
Yeah, if we were to do that, what recourse, if any, would either a small employer or an employee of a small employer have? What recourse would they have during the interim?
Well, they would have the same. In the interim, they won't have any now. If you're talking about picketing, that was the Supreme Court's already ruled on that. That advertising picketing is an expression of free expression of speech.
You maintain there's no recourse now, so.
There is none under the present law. And I don't think that you can amend this law as it's presently constituted to give any relief in this particular area. There seems to be some consideration.
What was the Senate bill you found?
Senate Bill 527.
527.
Would your estimation that would have done the job?
Absolutely. There is some flaws in Senate Bill 527 that need cleaning up, but I wanted to get something before the session in a printed form so that we'd have something to work on during the interim.
Mr. Stelton?
First time, the board has jurisdiction in these three cases. Number one, where employees or a union ask for a representative election. Or, in other words, a certification election. And number two, employees or a union saying that the present representative, union, is no longer representative and they want them out.
This is after a year.
And the third is about an employer who asks for a certification election.
That's right.
Those are the other three areas of jurisdiction that the board has. So, in a situation such as the one involving the market that the people are talking about, where the employer does not wish to deal with the union, he has no representation for, he has no recourse. There's no unfair labor practice.
I'm sure that the case you're talking about, the market basket here in Salem, their volume must have exceeded the jurisdiction in any event of the state.
They said that their testimony was that they had asked the federal government, the federal, the NLRB, to take jurisdiction.
Well, the case dragged on for months before any action was taken in either part.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that probably at the time that they asked for relief, that their volume wasn't what they might have had at the time that the problem started. Had they filed immediately, I think they could have qualified under the provision of the National Labor Relations Act.
Well, Oh, yeah, one more. I was raised this question privately with Sharon Rogers just a few minutes ago, but now we've got another bill coming in. We make some quite broad changes in the workers' comp system. Maybe what we ought to have is a 5-man interim today.
Well, I certainly would be all for it.
Take on this problem and study the workers' comp thing.
I think it would be excellent. I would strongly urge that something like that be done. As long as you can find such a thing as this to members of management and labor who are completely conversant on it, you don't have to educate a public member.
It
would be a better use for it than presently it's being used for.
I wonder when he's referring.
I wasn't talking about legislators in the same vein as public members.
Other questions, Mr. Allen?
You were on the previous dinner
with
the panel. Could you enlighten us a little bit as to what that committee tried to do, or what bill you were referring to?
Senate Bill 206 was the bill that came out of the committee. There were three senators. There was Senator Pearson, Senator Boyden,
and Robert White.
And Bob White from Marion County.
Representative Duncan, White, Gallagher.
Right. And the vote among those of the members of the legislature was 3-3. The Senate members all being for and the House members all being against. The three public members was Hellman Ludeman, Carl, who was that railroad
Gilson.
Gilson.
And Richard Jones.
Yeah, Dick Jones from Reed College. The votes all came out of the committee 6-3.
In favor of
the bill.
House members
voting no. Mainly on account of the procedure was followed. We had nothing against the package of labor management bills, but the Senate members and the public members would meet in private and determine what they were going to do, and then they'd call a public meeting, and we didn't even know what was coming up on the agenda.
Who was the chairman?
Bud Pearson. Or Boyden, one of the two, I can't remember which.
Huh?
Boyden was chairman.
Mr. Allen, on the floor.
In your deliberations, did you consider following the federal code we have in some other areas, such as taxation?
To the best of my knowledge, there would be no consideration given to anything. No, I'm serious when I say that.
You know,
what happened in 1959, the anti-picketing bill was repealed, and this brought about the hue and cry for an interim committee. And that was the interim committee that was the result of the 1959 sessions action when Joe was packing eggshells all over the House floor.
If any consideration is given priority to adopting pretty much substantially the federal code?
Not until the consideration was before this committee last time, and then the governor's office indicated interest. And like I say, both Mr. Congleton from ALI and I both kept trying to get the governor's office to appoint an ad hoc committee to come up with recommendations that would cost the state nothing. I mean, a joint labor management committee to come in with recommendations in this area. And of course, with all the other problems that he inherited, he never got around to doing this. But the bill that is in the Senate, I worked very closely with Ed Ranchfield, the governor's office, on the drafting. I hope that it could be used as a vehicle for an interim committee study to come up with recommendations 2 years hence.
You know, through your national organization, the international organization, national level of LCIO, where there are some small acts that they act along this line?
The one is considered as being the model act of Connecticut Act. I've read it. I would rather have something that conformed much more closely to the National Labor Relations Act. that's just a personal preference for the simplicity that would mean to small local unions and certainly small local employers. I mean, you wouldn't have two standards to go by. You have pretty much the same procedure all the way through, and it would certainly expedite petitions and that type of thing. If a petition was filed, the hearing could be held, and determinations made, and it wouldn't be dragging on and on and on. They tabled it over there for this because it was rapidly drawing to a conclusion in their views.
Well, we have a bill here that doesn't lend itself necessarily to substantive amendments, but it is an appropriation bill.
Well, you're going to have to increase that appropriation considerably if you're going to do a job in this area.
And if that's the thing, well, if we had to commit it, to have to be able to do it with, do you think it's too late to set if we ran for 2/3 of class?
I think it's, if you start getting into 527, you're going to have extensive hearings. Because it's an entirely new concept in the area of intrastate employment. And like I say, there is still some technical bugs in it, but I wanted to get something in so that people would have an opportunity to look at the thing and make recommendations. And I like the concept of a 5-member interim committee. As far as I'm concerned, you could instruct the governor to appoint such a committee and not even put an appropriation on it. I know there'd be plenty of people willing to serve at the cost of their own organizations and companies to take care of this thing once and for all.
Mr. Chairman, will Mr. Iman be able to do that? Do you know something about the German base that I've done that?
I read the new policy of the country.
Other questions, please? This could be a little more on firm footing in regards to the Assembly Committee. Are you suggesting that it be all legislators be on the committee and then taking the results of management and labor and coming up from those and suggesting to the next? Are you wanting some public members and some members representing management and members representing labor?
I would rather have 5 well-informed legislators compose the committee and let, I think that labor management could come in jointly and testify before them. And I think there's enough interest in the thing that we would have pretty much of unanimity of opinion as far as what is needed.
Okay. Now, would you idea a little bit more on the cost? Did you go into it when you introduced House Bill 527, the impact, financial impact of such a bill would be?
No, didn't have time to assess the thing. But I know it's a lot more than $6,800 or whatever this one is.
It's around
$15,000.
This isn't the kind of thing. This is $6,800. $15,210.
Run a pretty good interim committee for that.
Okay, other questions, Ned? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Anyone else on 2053? No one else has signed up, and no one else has volunteered. I'd be glad to hear Mr. Edmondson. Anything to say? Everybody seems to be shaking their head. Which day on 23? Jerry, do you have any more you want to say on this?
Culture.
there's any further questions, I'd appreciate trying to answer them.
Any questions, sir?
I want to let you folks know that I contacted Ullman the second time and asked him to use this material for the legislature.
Any questions for that guy, David? No, thank you very much, sir. Move on, Saturday. Benton County Farm Bureau.
My husband is the president of Benton County Farm Bureau, but he's farming. We have a little problem with the county farm. We realize that some rules need to be drawn up to govern the relations between farm labor and the farmers. Since certain laws were written and developed in other situations as founded industry, we feel that an entirely new law is needed. We are especially concerned that huge investment that we all have to make to bring a potential harvest time could be lost if the harvest is delayed in a very short time. And the rules that have been developed under NLRB are just too complex for most farmers to understand. And the lawyers that even understand these are not available in rural areas usually. I think it's important that we protect both the farmers and our labor, and we feel that HJM 23 does this, and that it is necessary that this be done on a nationwide basis in order to prevent any hardships that would develop if a single state would adopt legislation such as this.
Question is halfway. Joanne, you're opposed to this.
No, we are for this bill.
And you and Peter and you together on
it. Yes.
Other questions?
One. You think the lawyers in the Department of Agriculture have any rules and regulations that are easier to understand than the ones in
the... I don't think they could be any harder, let's put it that way. I think maybe they'd be more qualified to write them through farmers would understand.
Other questions? Good morning. Thank you very much. Paul Saunders, United Farm Workers. Let me ask this. Anyone else on the edge class for us? Excuse me, Paul. Howard?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, all I would like to do today is, in addition to what we mentioned at the last hearing, is to mention that in the U.S. Senate initial hearings on SA, which relate to bringing agriculture under the National Labor Relations Board, have been held. The initial hearings in the House will begin sometime this month. And to renew the emphasis on why this is needed, the United Farm Workers Organizing Committee appeared before the Senate. In addition to coverage of agriculture under NLRB and NLRA, they asked for exemption to a number of features in the National Act, which would exempt them, their organization, from a product boycott, secondary boycott, and also from Section 14B of Pat Hartley. So this again is a direction, if they would take this route, could destroy any part of the agriculture industry that might be subject to this type of activity. And so we feel a separate act to cover the peculiarities in agriculture is very vital at this time.
Question Howard? Mr. Martin?
Section 9 of the bill says, which establishes rules defining farm relationships in agriculture without involving the Labor Management Relations Act or the National Labor Relations Board. Who does that mean?
Well, this is
part of the agriculture?
No. We are asking that this particular act be set up under an entirely different structure, separate from the present act or from the jurisdiction of the NLRB.
Who then would be?
This would be another, it would be the Agricultural Labor Management Board that would be structured. Similar, it'd be a separate act and a separate organization, similar as the railroad act is set up at the present time.
And provide the secret ballot of my neighbors
The Department of Agriculture does have a field force under that jurisdiction in all areas of the country, which is, at the present time, in our thinking, is that this would be part of the structure under which elections could be held as an independent group.
Now, who would it be in,
Big pardon.
What's the office of Mahoney County?
Well, there are several USDA offices, the function of which are all different. It would depend on which branch of USDA that this would be assigned to.
I had the opportunity to go to Washington for a month and a half when I visited.
Situation that we have within the industry itself within
reveal that it needs to be a national situation rather than one that might be imposed on producers in any one state.
Other question, Howard? Yes, thank you very much, Howard.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Paul Saunders and then on the air.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I have something prepared to read here, but I've just done enough of that since I've gone off. I've heard references until they're running out of my ears of a perishable crop in relation to agricultural labor. Is this crop any less perishable after it leaves that field? When it gets in a teamster truck, or when it gets a farm show on the dock, or when it gets into the retail store, it's still just as perishable right there. We've been lobbying for legislation here, trying to get a chance to act as responsible people should act. But it seems like farmers seem to think that they're the only people that can act rationally or with responsibility. And they don't seem to want to give the farm worker a chance to act as a responsible or a reasonable person. I would like very much to see any group of farmers accept the invitation that I'm going to extend now, which is to sit down in any group, if they want to talk industry by industry, meaning beans, strawberries, and nuts, and whatever it is, sit down and talk with the United Farm Workers and come out of a meeting and say that they're not talking to rational and reasonable people. We don't need this thing on a big labor relations board. We don't need a labor relations board in this state if people will sit down and talk reasonably. But this hasn't been done. The sections in House Journal 23, that there are those that remove the remotest possibility of any responsible action. And, of course, they continue the general trend of this legislative session, which, by its inaction, will necessarily bear the responsibility for any broad action that we have, the broad-based action that we have to take this year. Because you have the power, this legislature, and this legislative assembly, the bills are before you. And I'm not speaking personally to members of this committee, but to the legislative session as a whole, to act upon, and nothing is being done. That's all I have.
Questions from Mr. Saunders? No, thank you very much, Paul. Ed?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm not going to bore you with a bunch of repetitious testimony because I did testify extensively on this first hearing. I can't help but think that here I was on this stand about 10 minutes ago arguing conformity both within the state and the interstate, inter and intrastate labor management relations. And here you have a concept that is completely foreign to any of the accepted labor management practices in the United States. I was very amused at Everett Martin's comment about the Department of Agriculture. Certainly we know that they followed up the forest program, they followed up the surplus commodity programs, and there's no reason to believe that they wouldn't follow this up beyond any recognition. I think we've got an established agency of federal government, the National Labor Relations Board, under the provisions of the National Labor Relations Act, fully qualified, with adequate field staff, certainly with years of experience in labor management relations, that could much better be the vehicle for the handling of agricultural workers and their relationship with their employers, the farmers of this state and of the nation. That's about all I have to say, because anything else would be what I've already said.
I can see why your concept, but I would refer you to Al Allman's letter. I don't know if you saw a copy of it or not. But
I saw a news statement.
Because I would welcome the expression that Oregon legislature depended on the degree to which you believe such coverage should be extended to agricultural workers. Then he goes on to say his personal opinion is that we should avoid bringing them under the Act, those agricultural operations employing only seasonal or harvest time labor. The benefits of the workers will be minimal, and the additional record keeping that imposes another serious burden on the already overburdened family farm operation. Well, do you feel that the answer is to bring them under the same act and the same rules and regulations as other people who negotiated areas?
Well, I definitely feel so. Only by doing that can they ever get proper recognition. This paternalistic attitude that farmers traditionally have held, as it affects their employees, whether they be seasoned or regular, I think is a concept of the Middle Ages and certainly should be brought up to the 20th century. The situation that's happened in California is a good example of it. Practically all of the things that the farm workers down there attempted to negotiate or tried to get the employers to recognize them so they could negotiate them become the past. Housing's improved. Certainly the hourly rate paid these people has improved. All of the sanitary things that were part of the problem have been improved. The recent series of stories regarding that situation in Delano, California, that was run in the Oregon several weeks ago, or 10 days ago, I guess, pointed out very vividly to me that the things that they're after can best be handled by proper recognition, by elections held under the supervision of the National Labor Relations Board, making the farmers, and of course the family farmers, practically a thing that's rapidly passing from existence. Corporate farms are more and more coming into the picture where they grow the crops, process the crops, market the crops, and in many instances even have chain outlets where they sell the crops. In all other segments of their operations, they have to operate under the National Labor Relations Act, and I can't see why they shouldn't do it with their farm workers.
For example, in town, especially in these days, there's very, very few that are controlled by the corporations that you're talking about. It's still there are a few corporations farm, but they're actually farming corporation or a subsidiary or something else.
I bet that's right. Take green beans, for instance. Blue Lake Cannery tells the farmer how many acres of beans.
The actual production is on an individual basis. It's not on the...
He can only be guaranteed that so many acres of his beans that he grows will be processed by the cannery.
This is on a contractual basis.
Sure, it's a contract. Why shouldn't he have, if he can have a contract with the processor, why can't he have a contract with his employees?
But I mean, his individual operation determines operation of the cannery determines what he's going to do as far as except in controlling the data. But his individual production, his individual expenses, he's the one that has to face the financial impact.
Sure.
Not the corporation that's giving the contract.
No, but they're all tied hand in hand.
No, I just...
And the guy that's on the lower end is the guy that's doing the harvest.
Any other question, Ed? No, thank you very much, Ed. Anyone else on page 23?
If you're going to testify, yes.
The third hearing on HM 23 will go to 1732, I believe the number is. Mr. Davis. Now, this bill, the information the committee is on the table. This is a bill is introduced by Paul Hoss. He is agreeable to him to use this bill, and Representative Davis will present a problem that has arisen, which he feels that should be a solution to it. And Representative Hoss has said that he's going to use this bill as a vehicle. The attorney's committee is going to pass the bill. It is tabled.
Well, just for the record, Mr. Chairman, I'll choose to take 1732 off the table.
Okay, if everyone's still moving, take 1732 off the table. All in favor of representative motion, and as I said before, an explanation is to use clearly the vehicle. The answer I just need to call those code more for the
vehicle is going to be used for. That's going to be different.
Well, I can't find it, my car's up here.
It's going to be different.
Oh, excuse me.
Did you get it, Mr. Chairman?
Aye.
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 Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for bringing, taking this bill off the table. The reason that I've asked that this be done is that the bill applies to the medical reports to be used in workman's compensation hearing determinations. When the three-way bill, the three-way program was first started, the idea was to speed up the process of making these determinations just as much as possible.
Excuse me, Dr. Chairman, do all of you have copies of these amendments, House Amendment House 1732, and Jake, do you have a copy of this?
Well, I'm going to look.
Plain, you have to.
Can you call the House of
Representatives? Yeah,
I have.
Okay. Excuse me, Bob. April 8th or May 1969.
The concept behind these determinations was to speed up the awards, and for this reason, the original law provided for the use of reports of doctors rather than making it necessary for the doctor to come and testify, and which would prolong the hearings, result in a great deal of expense to the doctors, to the claimants, and to the department, and so on. And the present law allows that. However, by reason of some a peculiarity, one statute that refers to physicians to the state of Oregon. In recent months, the hearings examiners have been ruling that the medical reports of physicians from outside the state could not be used in this manner. It would be necessary to bring the out-of-state physician here, which would result, of course, in more expense and so on. Now, I can see a reason for not allowing a person who is injured in an industrial accident to shop throughout the country for a doctor that will finally make a favorable report. However, I see no justification for requiring a treating physician of an individual to travel from out of state into state to testify at one of these hearings. And I'm thinking in terms specifically of a situation in which a young fellow received a rather serious injury after being released from the hospital. It was less expensive for him, and he went home to Seattle, where he was able to reside with his parents during his recovery, and received a good deal of medical attention and treatment by a doctor in Seattle. When the claim came up, the ruling was that you could not use a report. It would be necessary for the doctor to testify. Now, this amendment, which I propose, is that the underlying part that a treating doctor who is not a resident of the state of Oregon, the report should be used, providing that the employer or itself, insured, or the department has a reasonable time, but not less than 30 days after receipt of a copy of that report, in which they can either cross-examine the doctor by deposition or by written interrogatories, which should be settled by the hearings officer. This, I think, would protect the department and would at the same time make it possible in those rare instances in which somebody may be treated from out of state. I recognize that this is not any earth-shaking legislation by any means, but I guess it's only important to someone who
who's badly hurt and needs to report, and happens to end up with some treatment outside the state. I've talked to both representatives from management and labor about this, and I think it should work both ways, that in the event the doctor, or in the event the department wanted to send someone for treatment, an operation or something of that nature outside the state, although I think it would happen very infrequently, that should also apply. That this should also apply to the Department or the employer. I do think it straightens up something that no one really thought might happen at the time that the three-way bill was passed. That it would be completely fair. Once the officer hurt the Department or the employer, and that would be a benefit to the injured person. Do you have to answer any questions?
Question, Mr. Davis, Mr. Engel.
Am I to understand then that this cannot be done by a resident of Oregon?
Oh, yes, it can.
It can be done?
Yes.
It says not a resident. Well, the surgical report, many treating doctor who is not a resident of Oregon.
Well, but the existing law makes allows this now as to all treating physicians in Oregon. And also the examining physicians, but that this can't be done in Oregon. And the point being that this language would then make it possible to do it with only a treating doctor from outside the state.
Other question, Mr. Davis? More than a question I would have, supposing that a person, the family of the resident of Vancouver, which is across the state line from Portland, then if that doctor in a category where you can make the reports where he probably was just available to Dr. Norton, actually to Portland office.
Well, but of course, if he was practicing in Portland, he still would be able to make these reports, and it's done every day. In fact, it's been a great benefit to the workmen and to the employers and insurers that this is done in this way, so that you don't have these prolonged medical haggles in the courtroom. The reports are all come in, are introduced in evidence. The examiner uses them. This is done today, so it would just. In fact, that's a classic example. Is that with Vancouver or down in our area, maybe Guadalupe, the doctor happened to be from there, you have to bring him up. So the fact that you see a practicing doctor from Portland is not required to appear and testify.
Under a change of age, can be subpoenaed, though.
Yes, that is, and that's why under this situation, we provide the length of time for the deposition, either by written orally or by written interrogatory, so that you can't escape the cross-examination of the judgment.
But the doctor out of state could not be subpoenaed.
You can't. This is a problem. You can't even get in here unless you've done voluntarily.
Okay, any questions from Dr.
Why don't you take out the subsection? Why don't you take out the word also? And just say, from any doctor, you better go back. Why do you have to?
Well, because this part of a very complicated code that was passed, and then there, in two or three sections, you'll find references in areas which say physicians of the state of Oregon and so on. And by a combination of all of, by putting it together, about three or four statutes, they have the hearings officers have arrived at this conclusion. I hesitated to run the risk of doing more than was intended by going back and amending three or four statutes. I just thought by stating this five lines that we could make it clear and not run the risk of changing the law in such a way that it was not my intention to do.
You thought it's a lawyer's bill, it takes a lawyer to figure it out.
Well, it sure took a lawyer to come to the conclusion they did, I'll tell you that.
Other question about
I have a sense concerning that even though you have made mention of other statutes that make reference to Oregon positions, because we say that this subject, which has to do with the contents of medical and surgical hospital reports, so for compensation, so the final stage evidence is the matter contained there. And then we say that in a new subsection, and a new addition to this subsection, is from a medical report of a treating doctor who is not a resident of Oregon, whether or not I'm excluding all resident doctors by that standard.
No, but it
says for all purposes of this subsection.
No, it says this subsection shall also apply. That is the portion which is directly above. Shall also apply the medical or surgical reports from any treating doctor who is not a resident of the state of Oregon.
I feel better about it that in addition to the subsection applied to resident doctors, it shall also apply. I don't know, that's a technical question, and maybe the attention to compensation board or whatever the name is now, criminal process, you could look at this.
I would have no objection to that change in language, because that is exactly what the intention is.
I know that's what the intent is. I don't know what else to do in the process. Another subject, one other question. Okay. If you ever did the powers available, or
Jacob's copy.
So it does provide for time and a half of...
It provides for time and a half and overtime for everybody, whereas the law now provides for time and a half only for women. So this provides for time and a half for men as well. This is a, you know, this is an anti-discrimination bill, but this one is an anti-discrimination bill.
Now that time and a half of the minimum wage or time and a half of the wage which the fellow is enjoying at the present?
The hourly wage rate of being employed.
Well, then it does become more than the minimum wage.
Oh, time and a half in any, it's defined on page 3, lines 15 and 16. There's that such employees receive compensation for their employment in excess of 40 hours of work week at a rate not less than 1.5 times the hourly rate which they receive for. In that way, it fits the federal law, which is a time and a half. The other amendments that are made to it, and we're deleting that we're preparing, taking out section 3, which is the minimum wage part of it. We are putting in a new definition of people who are exempt under the federal limit, where there is a conflict between federal fair labor standards and the federal Bill of Rights Act, which is necessary. We're excluding individuals employed as senior hospital employees because of their Iraq hours of work.
What about agriculture employees?
Agriculture employees are excluded.
That would have this part from two cents.
It's an exclusion that you have now. Huh? Exclusion that you have now. You include domestic help. What it is. Intellectuals. So on and so forth. However, those people are you fall into an exclusion.
Does this include legislators?
Anyway, I'll move the doctor in there.
Steve?
Yeah.
What do you do about newspaper people, for instance, who are down here on assignment with the legislature? And you take it out outside salesmen, too?
No, you're outside salesmen.
Well, I'm 25. Individually engaged in capacity of an outside salesman.
Oh, no, those are in over here in Section 5, Bob. I'm sorry. Section 5 excludes these. The provisions of this act shall not apply with respect to any employee who is employed in a bona fide executive, administrative, or professional capacity, or in a capacity of outside salesman or taxi cab operator.
Okay, now how do I find an explanation of a bona fide executive, administrator, or professional?
We have something in this law, it's a matter of,
this law is federal statute?
Those are the words of the federal statute, yes.
One of my statutes would be a college graduate to the
But there's no wage determination or...
Well, the question of bona fide executives is one that's well known in this particular area of law to somebody who has administrative duties. There have been even sometimes you get all the way down to foreman or something like that. Each case has to be handled on its own individual basis, and you have to look at the job that he does or his employer. For instance, men who work in radio stations, disc jockeys, people like that have been held to be excluded because they are in the either a professional or an executive capacity.
Well, is the writer a professional?
I can say so, I mean, respect that.
Well, I'm glad when you say so. Now, will the people who administer the bill agree with you?
I think so. They would be documented as being standard as a professional.
Isn't there a whole framework of federal regulation to develop that around this particular language?
Yeah.
For example, they call them an exempt status. And through a purchasing agent,
does vary from one case to the other, I suppose, whether
the employer or the employer is
delegated to the
manager. And how the employer uses it. But any person who is in a genuine administrative or executive capacity is not covered by this law.
Thank you. All right.